welcome in. Doug Gottlieb here, and you are listening to All Ball, the all basketball conversation. And we got a great pod for you. Let me start with what everybody is talking about in collegiate sports, which is pay for play. Oh, I'm sorry. It's name, image, and likeness. No, it's really pay for play. So what happens is, I'm sure you read my tweets, or maybe you don't, and you're like, well, this guy, he doesn't want college athletes to get paid. He wants to keep all the money himself. Look, I'm just a realist about it. No, I don't think guys should be paid to play above what they get for a scholarship. Scholarship is pretty awesome. Getting into college you couldn't get into. Never really having to ask for money or for food, for clothes, for anything. Right? And like what you're not told is, like, well, what if you come from a household where you don't have any money? Like, okay, we can apply for a Pell Grant and get nearly $7,000 in a Pell Grant in addition to the cost of attendance and all the other stuff. Well, you can't work. You can work. I worked. I tended bar in the fall. In the summer, if you stay there, you get a job. But you also, like, the NCAA has created this thing where you don't have to work. You really don't have to. And you got everything kind of taken care of for you. And like, look, there's lots of different layers to get into it. But I think one of the important pieces, I believe that we all need college. We need that time away from home where you're not living at home as a child, but you're also not an adult out in the real world. And you need pieces of the real world. One of those pieces is the relationships that you build, knowing that all these people you're around are going to be your contemporaries in the workplace for the rest of your life. Another piece of the real world is learning how to manage your time and your money. That's really what you learn most in college, right? Is about relationships, building, fostering relationships, not just romantic, just friendships and otherwise. And how to balance your time and your money. Because you don't necessarily have to go to every class, but you got to go to enough of them we know you're doing. And if you want to get A's, you obviously do. But I also think that you need to learn to balance your time in that. How are you going to go work out? Are you going to go hang out? Are you going to study? What are you going to do with all of your time? And then with your money, you get a scholarship check. You know, you get $500-$600 above and beyond that of your rent check. What are you going to do with that money so that you have it a little bit to spend at the end of every month? And we've created this system where, managing money is not as important because now you can get a meal anytime you want. They can't cut you off from meals, whether it's training table or all the things that you can have inside of a training room. You know, there's additional monies you can make with working camps. And when coaches have these fantasy camps as well, you'll get an additional check. And there's ways to manipulate summer school so that you get paid based upon how many hours you take. You sign up for 18 hours, then you cut it down to like nothing in terms of 6 or 9 hours, and you still keep that check. There's lots of different ways in which you can have a little bit of a buffer between the real world and the fake world. But you still need to learn to manage money. And this idea that we're gonna have these small sponsorship deals. You go down to Chris's University Spirit, make an appearance, and you get $500. Forget about, well, you can't forget about, but this is going to hurt, I think, athletic departments who need that revenue in order to pay for all the things that they pay for. But it's also just going to hurt the general idea of what college athletics is about. Like, look, you're coming here to get everything taken care of. And if you're a good enough athlete, if you're good enough at your sport, when you're done playing, you can do a sign autographs. You can make appearances. You can get all that money. You don't actually need it now. And because you don't truly have a value, you're actually just getting paid to play, not getting paid for your name and likeness. It's not to say your likeness doesn't have any value, but really all it's done is we pooled them all together and athletic departments are able to sell them on everything they do. And that's a lot more valuable than any one person individually. But more than anything, it just gets away from the core ethics of what college athletics is about to the athlete. Your sport, your excellence in your sport got you into a college you couldn't get into, got you total support scholastically and athletically. It gets you a degree, creates these relationships. You learn about balancing time, about balancing money, about how to play as a team, about how to play hard. And when you're done, now how good you are determines what your first, second, sometimes third job is. So let's go a little bit further into it. All right. I've had people like Nick Wright lose their mind and say, you know, that's not a reason to, like, it actually is a legit reason. Many of you are in college athletics, or you've been around college athletics, so you know that you're not paying taxes on, like, ticket revenue. You're not paying normal taxes. So it allows those profits to be greater, the net to be as good as the gross or close to the gross. The problem is that, like, Gavin Newsom does this. Well, they're making billions of dollars. First of all, individual schools aren't making billions of dollars. Those are 20-year-plus deals signed by, you know, 10 to 14 member conferences. That when you split it up, is the money good? Yeah. But the expenses are also way higher than used to be. Like, we're only taking gross revenue and go like, look, now they're making $30 million a year. Yeah, but everything else costs money. Debt service is higher. All the coaches make more money. The insurance is more money. The travel is more money. The offices are more money. The secretary is more money. Like, everything costs more money. And so, yeah, the revenue, they've been able to generate more and more revenue than they ever have before in collegiate athletics. They're also generating more revenue on the academic side, but no one seems to be attacking that. Colleges make money off of all their students. The only difference is the reward for being on scholarship now is actually greater than it used to be. It's a scholarship for a lifetime. The facilities are better. Schools are hard to get into, and yet for athletes, you still have the opportunity to get in when others would not. You can come back whenever you want, get your degree, even get an advanced degree and be on the field or on the court coaching. You know, you get cost of attendance now where you didn't previously. Like, the deal is incredible. And this idea that taxes don't matter. Hey, if you start paying college athletes, they can be deemed employees. If they're employees, then all of a sudden all of their things that they get, not just the money and not just the scholarship, all can be taxed. And sometimes some are in fact taxed and schools pay that already. But now anything they get can be seen as a benefit and be taxable. And then if they start taxing athletic departments, now all those other sports will, of course, suffer. So I get it. You somehow think that kids could go, why can't a kid go out? Because it's not what we're about. The reward is the scholarship. It's an incredible reward. It's harder to get than it ever has been previously. It's more valuable than it ever was previously. And you get more once you get there for the rest of your life than you ever have previously. And yet part of our makeup is we want more, which is also why if you have this, it won't stop cheating. Whatever rules you put in place, if people want to go around the rules, they will. You pay a kid $5,000 and somebody says, I'm going to pay you $10,000. I don't think the rules as they stand are unreasonable. Most people who live it don't think it's unreasonable. And yes, schools are making money, but you have to remember they're making money off everybody. Are they making more money than they used to? Yes, they're also spending more money than they used to. Not just to get the next college athlete, but also to treat them better when they're there. And the taxes do, in fact, matter. So I get that we act like this is a foregone conclusion. I think it's really interesting because in a couple years, the NBA is probably going to take guys straight out of high school. They can already go straight out of high school to the G League. They don't, even though they can market themselves there. I'm not sure the NCAA doesn't dig in and say, look, if you want to go to the minor leagues, you can. If you want to go here, this is our rules. I'd be interested legally what they can do, considering they're not a free market, nor have they ever portrayed themselves as a free market. Right now, they're losing against public opinion, but that doesn't mean they're losing in the court of law. Anyway, so look, we could go round and round, and I think by now you've heard my opinion on it. I think here's the thing that bothers me the most, is if I had to say there were three groups that have bitched and complained about name, image, and likeness, all three groups piss me off. And I guess I respect at least two of them, maybe even three. Gavin Newsom, he's an elected official. By the way, like, look, he went to Santa Clara. How much do you think it cost to go to Santa Clara? Imagine if you got that for free and you couldn't afford it. But, like, Gavin Newsom talking about some shit he has no idea about, saying a student athlete gets nothing. Like, it, just in the state of California, the idea that you can go to Cal, Stanford, UCLA, get into these schools you couldn't get into, walk away with no student debt, And especially when, you know, those athletic departments are not, they're not rolling in money. Like to poo-poo the education and opportunities when you're supposed to be, as an elected official, wanting more and more of those opportunities, especially from people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. But more than anything, like, he and LeBron James, hey, you didn't fucking play college basketball. You haven't earned a scholarship. Like, LeBron, this doesn't affect you. You were getting paid in high school anyway, right? That's like the Ed O'Bannon thing. Like, Ed O'Bannon leading this charge. Like, dude, Ed O'Bannon, why do you think he signed at UNLV? And then all of a sudden he goes to UCLA after UNLV gets on probation. And by the way, Ed, like, I don't know why. It's weird. Like, Ed O'Bannon has always been a super class guy and was a great player and national player of the year. And it didn't work out for him in the NBA. And yeah, I guess he hasn't used his name and likeness to kill it. But that's a UCLA and a U problem. Because most everyone else in the real world, if you go to a college and play basketball and have the career that Ed O'Bannon has, you'd be calling their games right now. You'd be around their athletic department right now. You'd be earning a salary because of who you were. He didn't, and I don't know why that's everybody else's problem. And I feel like, so like LeBron, who, this doesn't pertain to you. You didn't, if you played college basketball, I do think you'd have a different perspective on it. Same thing with Gavin Newsom. The last group is the Dukies. Billis is big on this. We've had him on the pod. He's actually a good friend and a mentor. Jay Williams, I don't know if he's my friend or not my friend. I can't tell based upon the day. But I generally like the guy and love the fact that he's gone through some really dark times in his life and is now super successful in this profession. But are we fucking kidding ourselves? Like, the Dukies all have their jobs because, for the most part, they were really good players. Sometimes, like Jay, great players. But because they went to Duke, it's like they're skulls, you know? They have the secret combination. They get the secret handshake. So they live on their reputation that was established when they played. Jay Williams, everything he's done, it's not because he was the second pick in the draft and because he played for the Chicago Bulls, you know, or that tragic accident. Like, the reason that he has had all of these opportunities was he was a great player at arguably the best basketball school in the country, coached by the best basketball coach in the history of modern day basketball. And that opens doors for you, even 10 years after you're done playing. And so for the Dukies to complain about the system, which they benefit from more so than anybody else, I find to be at least ironic. At least ironic. But alas, this seems to be a path that many of you think you want to go down. And I'm going to point this out. It strikes me as the beginning of the end of college athletics and what it was about. And in this day and age, when it's harder to get into and harder to pay for college than it ever has been before, you will go back and you will say, Gottlieb was right. It was better the way it was. It just was. It was better the way it was. Yeah, people in charge make a little bit more money than maybe you think they should. Welcome to life, buddy. All right, let's get you to a really, really fun conversation. Rob McClanahan is the workout guy of the stars. He has a new book out. It's called Net Work. Get it? Net Work. It's really kind of an interesting tale of a guy who was a good player in high school, walk-on in college, to being the guru for so many of the superstars of the NBA.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
All right, let's welcome him into the All Ball podcast. He's Rob McClanahan. He joins us I want to talk about a bunch of things. Let's start with your journey, because now people reading about you, hearing about you, understanding how you work with so many NBA stars on kind of perfecting their craft. You grew up where?
I grew up in Rhode Island, Cranston, Rhode Island. So I'm born and raised there, went to a Catholic all-boys school here, and then ended up walking out of Syracuse.
So, wait. See, like, you skipped over a whole bunch of stuff. Like, how good were you in high school?
I was an average player. I didn't really play my junior year. Started my senior year, won a state championship. Probably could have played Division II. Somewhere, but definitely no D1 offers at all.
So then you apply, why'd you go to Syracuse?
Well, initially the plan was, you know, go there for broadcasting, media kind of stuff. It's what I kind of wanted to do. And then decided, you know, I'll try to walk on.
So you get to Syracuse, you walk on. Your freshman year, did you try and walk on?
I tried to walk on my freshman year. You know, growing up in Providence when the Big East was, you know, the real Big East.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really I really got in the love of that, you know, part of the game. And, yeah, I tried to walk on my freshman year. I remember getting in touch with Mike Hopkins and Louis Orr and those guys. And they said, you can work out with the team. Doesn't mean you're going to, you know, you're gonna make the team unless your dad, you know, donates a nice check. And that wasn't happening. So, coach let me, you know, work out with the team. I didn't make it my freshman year. They took no walk on. So I asked what I had to do. They said, you know, put on a lot of weight. You know, hopefully you'll grow a little bit. I was 6 feet, and I put on 30 pounds, grew 2 inches, and ended up making the team.
All right. So you make the team in 98, right? That was
yep.
the team we
yep.
played against in the NCAA tournament, if I recall. 98, yes. 99 in Indianapolis. Let's see here how many I can get.
That was a noon game on Thursday.
I know. Those are the best or the worst. It all depends. We actually played
we
that game 2 years. Yeah, because your season's over, or you get to watch everybody else win, and you already won like that. So it became
right.
So that team was Eton Thomas, Ryan Blackwell, Jason Hart.
Yep.
Who else is on that?
Alan Griffin, Damone Brown.
The team was talented, but not very good. Like, why wasn't that team better?
Yeah, you know, I don't think we had a lot of shooters, you know. And I don't know what it was, man. We were just up and down all year. You know, we went 4 in a row, but then we lose, you know, 2 or 3 straight. We just didn't come together when we needed to. And I remember being watching the tournament with Coach and, you know, being Syracuse and – we're like, you know, we got that noon game. It's just the vibe wasn't good. And then if we won, we would have played Auburn. I think we're the one seed, if I'm right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So that was the only year I was there where we actually lost in the first round.
Okay. So what did you, for your profession, what you do today, what was it about that experience at Syracuse that you learned, that you drew upon? Because I will say that, like, and people think I'm like anti-Syracuse is dumb, whatever.
yeah.
But I do think that I think not playing man-to-man hurts those guys. You know, like Jason Hart. Now, it didn't hurt Jason Hart, who became a great kind of tough, hard-nosed defender in the NBA and lasted for over a decade, whatever. But I do think that for four stars, like look, they literally don't learn anything about man-to-man defense during their time there. And there's also kind of a mentality that has to be changed. Offensively, I feel like Hop late in his run there, maybe the last Final Four team, they ran a little bit more kind of higher level stuff, but it's very, very basic in terms of what they do offensively. I don't know if that hurts guys, but and maybe it's that Syracuse has had guys that were underrated going into Syracuse that became overrated because Syracuse is such a big program and is so successful in the Big East. And then they, because they were maybe overvalued, they get to the NBA and they don't, outside of Carmelo, they don't have the same impact. But I'm wondering what about your experience at Syracuse. First, why did it help you get to where you are today?
Yeah, I think the main reason I fell in love with the workout stuff initially was because of Mike Hopkins. You know, he's really, really good at play development. His mentor was Gergerich, you know, Gerg. And so it was kind of, yeah, I didn't know. I just thought working guys out was, you know, putting through a couple of drills, you know, passing the ball, rebounding. But Hop was in there, like, same way he played, taking charges from Jason Hart in a workout, things like that, talking trash, sweating, and being a major part of the workout, not just passing the ball. So I thought that was pretty cool. I was in a lot of those workouts in the guard groups. So he was definitely my mentor early on, kind of still is, you know, with all that stuff. And, you know, that's when I first learned what working guys out really, really can be. And Jason Hart was a workout phenom. I mean, this guy was nonstop. You know, he improved every single year. So watching Jay go through his workouts with Hop was really cool to see.
It's funny because it's like everybody wants a guy like Hop to be. I didn't have that. Like Sean Sutton worked me out, but it wasn't. And he was great, but because he did so much more coaching, like once the season started, I didn't have a guy, and so I didn't feel like I kept up with my workouts. And, you know, look, my thing became I didn't think I could shoot, so I wouldn't shoot. And nobody believed I could shoot because I didn't believe myself. But I didn't have anybody kind of supporting me. Like, that's kind of the magic to what Hop does, right? Is that
yes.
is that not only does he work you out, but he gives you this dying belief in yourself that you think you can achieve, which allows you to achieve.
Yeah, his energy is ridiculous, you know, and he's always positive. Jason Hart and him were extremely close. And he believed in Jason. And again, he was kind of like that too, you know. He couldn't really shoot that much. No one believed he could shoot. And at times, Jason didn't think he could shoot. And Hop was the one, like you just said, that made him believe, you know, through the work. And it's kind of like when I work guys out, you know, if you work out all summer, you go into the season, like, you're confident you're going to make shots. You know, I always say it's like, you know, taking a test in high school. If you have an exam on Friday, study all week, you go in there pretty confident. If you study in the bus Friday morning for the first time, you go in there like, oh, God, you know, I'm not going to do well on this. So Hop was really good at that. He held you accountable. You know, there were times, Hop, if you didn't show up for the workout, he would go to your room on campus and get you up. I mean, literally, he would do that. And his energy was great. And every practice in all my years at Syracuse, they still do it. Every practice starts with play development. It was, you know, 20 to 30 minutes, guard group, big group, small forward group. And at that point, it was, Bernie Fine, Louis Yar, and then Hop. And then later on, it was Trey Weaver. But, and that was a big thing at Syracuse, just getting better. You know, the practices weren't long because we didn't really have to scout too much. We, you know, the zone and that kind of stuff. So it was really just working guys up before practice, at practice, and after practice.
It's fascinating. Fascinating how different. Yeah. And Hop has told me that, like, it's one of the things about playing a zone is that you'd be amazed at how much it allows you to focus on other things. Okay, so your last year at Syracuse was what year?
So 2001. We started out 19-0. And we ended up losing in the first round of the Big East tournament to Miami, and that killed our seeding. We were probably going to be a 2 seed because of that loss. I think we're the only 19, 1 seed to lose to a 9 seed. And because of that loss, we went to a 4 seed. And we ended up playing Michigan State in the Sweet 16 in Auburn Hills. And Bingham was not happy about that seed, obviously. But, it would be Kentucky in the second round. In Cleveland, with Tayshaun Prince and those guys, we won by a point. And we were feeling good about ourselves. We were a really good team. And I think we were up like 15 at the half on Michigan State. And I remember the first play, I think, and to come out of the second half, Izzo drew up a play for like a back to a screen to Mo Pete for an alley-oop, and the place went nuts, and that was it. they won by like 12. It was like 30-point swing or something in the second half. It was incredible. So that was a tough way to end the season because that was a year, I think, you know, we were Final Four team, but the seeding didn't help, and the losing in the first round of the Big East really killed us.
So you graduate, and then what?
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to coach in college. So they had made a call for me to Seth Greenberg. And without even really interviewing, I got the GA job at South Florida.
Wait, before you get to the South Florida one.
Yeah.
Didn't you play for Syracuse against Providence, like your last Providence game, your senior year?
Yeah.
What was that like?
So it was actually my junior year. So it was the 2000. So yeah, 2000 was my junior year. That's when we lost to Michigan State. So that was really cool because my family has 7 courtside seats, and that's how I grew up, loving the Big East. And so it was funny because we played at Providence. We're 18-0 at this point, and about to be 19-0. We're up big. He puts me in the game. Place goes nuts. And my family, and my mother, my father, everybody, you know, had this sign, Rob the Orange Man, that went like all the way across the first row opposite, you know, our bench. So I'm like, oh, you got to be kidding me. But it was great. I got a shot up, missed it. But that was really cool because that's where I won the state championship too at the Civic Center there, the dunk. And so, you know, kind of came full circle for me. So that was a pretty cool moment.
All right. So Boeheim calls Seth Greenberg and gets you a GA job at South Florida. And full disclosure, I know Seth. Seth's like kind of like an uncle to me, right? He used to be at Long Beach State. When I left Notre Dame, he recruited me. I know, you know, Brian Yankelevich, I think, was on staff there. So was Dave Zimroth.
And Clyde Vaughn.
Right, and Clyde Vaughn, right, who was a great player at Pitt, obviously his longtime right-hand man. So you're fresh out of college. All you know is all you know is Rhode Island and Syracuse hoop. You show up at South Florida. What was that like?
Yeah, I took my mother's car, drove down in her Camry, and moved in Tampa there, in their campus, and it was cool. I kind of did everything, you know, like a GA does. I helped break down film, actually work guys out. I was actually the backup point guard for practices. So it was a different I didn't realize that college was like that in the sense where it's not a lot of basketball. You know, it's making sure, you know, kids are in school, make sure that they get fed, you know, running camps, recruiting, sending out letters, you know, you can't work guys out more than like an hour a week, you know. So in that sense, I wanted to be on the court, and I didn't enjoy it as much as I thought I would, quite honestly. You know, but me and Yank became very close friends. Z was my roommate on the road, Zim Roth, so he was a great guy to talk to because, you know, he's done a lot. He's been Kennedy and those guys. So and Clyde Vaughn was great. So I had some good guys around me. But the experience of not being on the court all day long, I didn't really like. So I ended up, you know, leaving there in May. But we had a good year. We're 7-0. Fifth game of the season. I'm sorry, eighth game of the season, we played at Syracuse, which was crazy for me. You know, 6 months removed from Syracuse, here I am, you know, on the other bench. And we ended up losing the game. But that was my only scout of the year. was Syracuse.
So you leave in May, and what'd you decide to do? Go off on your own then?
Yeah, while I was down there, Doug, I met the guys at IMG Academy. So, you know, everything happens for a reason. And I met Joe Bunasar and those guys at IMG, and that's when they had a junior college. They didn't have any facilities to work guys out at. And I was like, wow, you can work guys out for a living. This is kind of cool. You know, so went home, went back to my high school, Bishop Hendrickson High School, became a phys ed teacher, moved in with my mother, so things are going really well. And every summer, because I had summers off, because I was a teacher, phys ed teacher, I interned at IMG Academy with Joe and rebounded for Garnett, Ty Lue, Tayshaun Prince, Al Harrington. And, you know, kind of that's my first look into really, you know, working guys out, you know, full time, you know, for a job.
Okay, so when did you make it into a job?
Well, then Joe left IMG in 06, 07, opened a facility, Impact Basketball, in Las Vegas. He took me as a right-hand man, did that for a year. That was like Jared Dudley, Ryan Gomes kind of guys, Telfair. And then I met B.J. Armstrong and Bob Myers and Arn Tellem at Wasserman. And I was recommended through Troy Weaver at the time, who I think was with the Thunder or Jazz. And Troy was my assistant at Syracuse my senior year. And they wanted a workout guy full time, which didn't even exist. So Arn flew me into his house, and Bob Myers, DJ, and came up with this idea. Hey, let's hire out full time, do a pre-draft, work guys out in the summer at St. Monica's High School, and see guys during the year. They had a guy like that before a little bit, part-time. You know, Neil O'Shea, who's now with the Blazers. But after him, it was they brought me in, but this time it was full-time.
So who was the guy who you first kind of became their guy and had kind of that first initial relationship with? Because that's generally kind of, I feel like, how it works is, like, yeah, you were working for Arn and working out all his guys and popping in, and but there's usually a guy or two that you connect with that really kind of knights you, if you will, to the rest of the NBA community.
Yeah, definitely. I'll rewind a little bit. My first couple of guys that I had that were pro were Ruben Garces, who was a pro at the time overseas, mm-hmm. and Ryan Gomes was a junior at Providence. And Ryan, I worked out Ryan for free, became All-American. And then he went pro, kept me on. But my first big break was getting at the ABCD camp. And I hounded Sonny. I mean, hounded him. There's a story in my book about how I faxed his house every day for like 50 days because he wouldn't return my calls. So I literally faxed his house. Finally, Bobby Hartstein calls me. The director says, "You got to stop faxing." He said, You're in.
Okay.
So that was a big break. I got in my first year. I coached Matt Doherty, who just got fired at Carolina. And I met Sonny. And I said, "Thank you." He said, "Who are you?" I said, "I'm Ron McClendon." And he goes, "Oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah." You had every coach in the world call me. You faxed my house. I like your persistence, but man. And from there, we became extremely close. And that's where I met Derrick Rose and Kevin Love. So you fast forward to when Arn hired me, he ended up signing Derrick. I already had a relationship with Derrick. Kevin went with another agent, but I still worked him out. And those are the first two guys that I became extremely close with. And then Kevin said, "Can I bring in my roommate, you know, at UCLA?" I said, "Who's your roommate?" "This guy, Russell. He played a little bit last year. He's all right. Do you mind if he comes by?" It was Russell Westbrook. So crazy, because then, you know, the 08 draft, you know, we're in that class, and I had all three of those guys on top of Brook and Robin, Gallinari, and DJ Augustine. So it happened very fast for me. But I would say Derek and Kevin and Russell was my first main group, you know, for 3 years every day. That kind of helped me get to where I wanted to be.
In your book, and the book is Network, in the book it does talk about Kevin Durant as this ridiculous workout fiend. Like he and I have, there's a story Scotty Brooks told me. And Scotty told me, I remember back when he was coaching Oklahoma City, he told me the first time they made the playoffs and they lost to the Lakers, they had exit meetings like the next day, and he had Kevin in, and he goes, "What are your plans?" He's like, "I don't know. I want to go hoop." And he's like, "Kevin, listen, you've been hooping, you know, since you got in the NBA. Like, I want you to take 2 or 3 weeks and not touch a basketball." He's like, "I got you."
Yeah.
He's like, so he literally put on speakerphone, called his travel agent. He's like, "Hey, we went to this island, like, I don't know, the Maldives or something. Like, I'll set you up. You'll go, like, don't hoop." He's like, "Oh, I got you. I'll figure it out." So he's like, "All right, where are you going now?" He's like, "Well, I'm going back home." He's like, "Okay, check in with me tomorrow, but don't hoop. Give yourself a couple of weeks to just clear your brain." So the next day, he couldn't get a hold of him, couldn't get a hold of him, couldn't get a hold of him. Finally, he texts him back. He's like, "Everything okay?" And he's like, "Yeah, I'm just checking in with you, Kevin." And KD's like, "Sorry, I was just hooping for the last 3 hours," right? Like, he's ridiculous that they had to, like, dial back practices because all those guys in Oklahoma City were just going to follow his lead, and he would have these, like, hour-and-a-half, two-hour workouts after their practices, and they felt like it would hurt the team if they were doing long practice in addition to. So is he, of the guys you worked with, does he have kind of the greatest energy for working out, or who else is in that class?
Oh, yeah, he's probably no. I mean, he's right there with Russell. Russell's one guy I've had a turn down. But the Durant thing is right on cue. I mean, Durant would fly me in once a month for 5 years, work out in season. Now, we would just go 30 minutes. But it's crazy because, you know, OKC, they have very strict rules about having people come in. Even though I was close to Sam and obviously Troy, they don't want to, you know, bend any rules for anybody. So I remember saying to them, "Hey, listen, Kevin Durant, he's going to find a gym." So, but they're like, "We just can't bend the rules." So I remember one trip, me and Kevin found like this little church gym, and it was about an hour and 20 minutes round trip just to work out for 40 minutes at 10 at night. I told a story on Moj's podcast the other day about we flew to Paris from LA one time, and we got stuck in on a private plane in New York, and we had delayed 6 hours. We landed in Paris. It's a 20 hour trip. We land at midnight. And this guy wants to work out. And I said, "Right now?" He said, "Yeah, could tell those guys, you know, up front to find a gym." I said, "Oh, my God." So we found a gym. I think it was like Tony Parker's like club team gym or high school. And we worked out for like an hour and a half. And it's one of the best workouts I've ever seen anybody have. And, he's
like,
he's unbelievable.
Like, in what way? I mean, like, when you try to relate to people, it's one of the best. What about the workout, for example, do you remember that made it so epic?
I mean, besides the fact that we were all exhausted. We just landed in Paris. It's 1 a.m. You know, having that in the background, he made every single shot. His energy was ridiculous. Forget that it was 1 a.m. in Paris. It could have been noon. The energy was top-notch. And it was just, I don't know what it was. It's just, he made everything. We worked on posts, high posts, transition. And we could have gone 3 hours. I was the one like, "All right, we got to stop. It's, you know, 1:30 in the morning here." But that's just how Kevin is, and it's like, you know, it's, that one workout is why he's great. But when you do that all the time, you know, that adds up. And Russell's another one that I had to take days off. So I know where Scotty's coming from with that, because one time I said, "Russell, take Sunday off. Let's get after it Monday. Just give me one day. You just rest." He said, "I got you." Okay, you're right. Because I always say rest is actually part of the training schedule. It's not that I'm being lazy. I want you to rest, you know, so you can recover. And I got a call from someone at UCLA. It might have been like Scott Garson. I'm one of those guys. And he said, "Your buddy's up there shooting." I said, "Oh, my God." So he's out there working out with his father on a Sunday afternoon. So
my Russell Westbrook story I heard from an NBA guy was they went to see the Rico Hines workouts at the men's gym. And Russell was over on his own court with the gun, you know, with the machine that fires balls back. And they watched, like, dudes were stopping and watching him because he was going full speed for 45 minutes, getting shots up, and just at a... Okay, so here's the question, though. right? Russell Westbrook is a great player, and he has a great work ethic. And yet, most guys, the older they get in their career, they start to lose a little bit of the juice in their legs, and their shot gets better. How come, by your estimation, he struggled last year with the shooting?
He definitely struggled. What's the question? Why do you struggle, you think?
It's kind of counterintuitive. It's not a work ethic thing. It's not like he's not working at it. And it's honestly not like his hands aren't bad. Was there something traumatic mentally? Why, as a guy who you know Russell, like one of the things is when you work out with guys, you spend this much time with guys, you know them as well or better than they know themselves. Why did he have a year where it felt like a step back shooting wise, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think Russell puts, a ton of pressure on himself, and he wants to will his way, to win every game, sometimes on his own. So I think, if you look back at some of his shots, I think shot selection has a lot to do with it. His mid-range we worked on for years, and it's one of the best in the game. As you know, that elbow area is perfect for him. But his form's fine. His legs are fine. It's a valid question, But I think in the end, sometimes with him, it might be just shot selection, sometimes he shoots fadeaway three. Sometimes he'll shoot a 30-footer. But when he gets in that 15, 17, 18-foot range, he's ridiculous. I don't know what he shot from three last year. I know it wasn't good. But I think, hopefully, I think this year, with having more shooters, I think, around him, the percentage might go up because I think he might take better shots. And maybe less shots, too, with James out there.
Yeah, well, it's going to be fascinating.
It really is, yeah.
What about John Wall? What's he like? I know there's a story in your book about him texting you mid-game. I'm not sure. What was he texting you mid-game?
Yeah, I think he was in Boston. And I was at the game, and I think he shot, it might have been playoff time against the Celtics second round, I think, a few years ago. And I think he shot, 1-for-10 or something. And he just said, because I was, second row. He said, what are you seeing, man? What the heck am I doing? And I just said simply, he's not following through. John, sometimes, when he misses shots, he kind of flicks it and runs away instead of just staying with a shot. Yeah. And Derrick Rose was the same way for a while. But that's all I said to him. Just follow through, man. Hold it up there. Sometimes you're just flicking and running away. So that's pretty much it. A lot of these guys haven't changed their shots. Derek and somebody didn't have bad form. It's just they might have a little hitch and then follow through. And to me, it's not rocket science. I don't need all these gimmicks. It's just basketball.
When you fly in to work out a guy, right, and you come in and now everybody in the league knows who you are, what's that like for the team? How do teams treat you? Because teams have their own player development coach as well. Many of them, I have friends who they used to do this and then they joined a team to kind of get in the league. And you come in, what's that feeling like for you? How do they treat you? How do you handle it? How do you feel?
Initially, it wasn't great feeling. No one really knew who I was. And not only that, but it's like, what's going on here? When I started doing this, there wasn't really anybody else doing it. So it's like, what is this? They didn't really know what it was. Fortunately for me, it was mostly franchise guys, so they weren't going to complain too much. But, there's a story one time about Nick Van Exel not being happy. I was working at Al Horford, and, he just didn't, why are you flying this guy in? I'm right here. And Al wasn't saying Nick was bad. It was just more I've worked with Rob for 3 years. We have a strategy and a workout that we do. And it's just basically maintenance. A lot of resistance early on for sure. But as we went through the years, and my rotation got a little better, ended up working out just fine.
It's funny when you were in high school and then you're at Syracuse and. We always used to have big guys like, man, stop shooting threes, get into the hoop and work on your post game. And now all of a sudden, now it's Brooke Lopez is shooting threes where he never shot them before. And it's just, it's fast. How have your workouts evolved during your time? Because, this has been 15 years you've been doing it, and the league has changed so dramatically, right? Like, I mean, think of how good a scorer Carmelo was, okay? But Carmelo was a great scorer in the post and in the mid-range, and probably the thing he lacked the most was, you know, the ability to shoot the three. Like, now the game is so incredibly different. How's it changed your approach?
A lot. It's funny you brought up Brooke, because 2 years ago, when Brooke, you know, didn't have a deal, he came in and he decided to move to L.A. for the summer, train with me, because I did his pre-draft. We're very familiar with each other. He said, dude, I need to get my game. And Brooke could always shoot, as you know, but he never really was put in a position to do it. So he said, I need to work on threes, man, pick and pop, you know, transition threes, things like that. And I said, all right, let's do it. So he signed a $2 million deal minimum with Milwaukee. And we worked out all summer long. I don't think we did the post one time. And it was the opposite in pre-draft. Honestly, like, he, all he wanted to do was shoot. You know, typical big man, I can shoot too. But I said, you're not a perimeter guy. You're going to play your 7-1. You know, so.
And he's got great feet. He's got great feet. Like, he's very mobile down there.
Very mobile. And great moves down there. Plays slow, which I love. But it's funny you said that, because, you know, Brooke was the first example that I had of 10 years later. It's like the opposite workout when I did with him in pre-draft in 08. So, and he ended up, you know, killing it for Milwaukee, and signed $54 million. So from $2 million to making, like, you know, whatever, $13 million a year, $14 million a year. So the game has changed completely. So I've definitely had to tailor my workouts for that. There's no more, you know, quote-unquote big men. I mean, Kevin Love's a good example. About 6-7 years ago in Minnesota, especially Rick Adelman, we started doing more stuff with the elbow, pinch post, you know, pick-and-pop stuff with him and Kmart. So he was the first one I kind of did that with, because I knew he could shoot. But as we went on throughout the years, past five years especially, I mean, I've had to really work on, you know, teaching these 6'10 guys to shoot 18-footers, you know, and now you have 6'9 point guards and 6'9 centers. So it's changed completely. And quite honestly, if you can't shoot in this league, it's going to be tough to stay there,
yeah.
You know, and that's why I think Ben and Giannis really have to work on that, especially in the playoffs. You know, I mean, in the playoffs when the scouting report's out there and guys are playing you at the far line, and now that's tough.
Okay, let's go to Steph Curry, who wrote the foreword for your book. The book is Network, net like basketball work. You first met Steph when?
I would say about his fourth or fifth year in the league before he's an all-star. He was in town in L.A. doing some commercials, and through his agent, Jeff Austin, he came in to work out. This is when he's coming off, you know, the ankle injuries, things like that, and worked him out at a private gym in Bel Air. And
is that the one that looks like Staples?
Yes.
That's pretty cool. Right. There's
a gym I use pretty much every day. So.
Yeah, and for people who don't know, like, we won't give away location. There's the gym, and NBA teams actually practice there.
Shoot-arounds and everything.
Yeah, where it looks just like the Staples, it's the same Staples Center floor or whatever, and they have pickup games there and obviously workouts there. So you meet Steph. What was your opinion before you met him?
Well, obviously besides the shooting, you know, I think he had to get more in control. You know, a lot of bad turnovers. I think he could do a lot of stuff and less dribbles. But besides that, I thought his game was unbelievable. I heard about his work ethic, and I heard about what a great human being he is. You know, so when we first met, I kind of just gave him a kind of a generic first workout, you know, that I do with a guy, and kind of get to know each other. But it's funny because he talks about in the forward, you know, like 5 minutes in, he was going hard. I was like, okay, I'm going to pick it up now. Next thing you know, talking trash, bumping him. And you couldn't believe it. I mean, I know this guy for 10 minutes, and I'm already in there, you know, guarding him. I mean, kind of like Hop taught me, you know. And, you know, from there, it's just we continue to have a great relationship and continue to train.
Okay, so in terms of Steph, how did it proceed, right? So you have that first workout, and was he like, mm-hmm. Was he on the Kool-Aid right then? Like, when can we do this again? Or was it, hey, I'm in L.A. and, you know, next time I'm on L.A., I'll hit you?
No, we kept going. He stayed in L.A. for a few more days. He came back, I think, a couple weeks later. And this is, I would say, August, so now we're approaching Labor Day and training camp. And then he had me fly into Oakland for about 10 days before training camp. And it was kind of cool, too, because this was the time that Bob Myers just got hired, and Bob was my boss for a long time. Mark Jackson was there. I worked on Mark's son for a while, so it was very easy transition to go in there and work about the facility, things like that, very familiar. So it wasn't one of those things, who's this guy? Made it much easier for everybody. And then Steph signed to Under Armour, started doing all these Under Armour tours in Asia, brought me with him to every single one. And then we started the SC30 camp, which has been unbelievable. The top 30 players in the country every year. At first, it was just guards. Now it's some bigs, too. But, you know, met a lot of guys through that. And, kind of just from that one workout, kind of just took off. And here he is doing the forward, which I, you know, really appreciate.
So what's a – what in terms of – like, Miles Simon's one of my dear friends. Obviously, he was a player development coach. Now he's the assistant coach with the Lakers. And one of the guys that used to be his guys was Chris Bosh. And he tells me a story of after his first year of playing with LeBron, he was like, look, I got to work on my catch and shoot, like mid to deep mid-range stuff, all the way out to three. It's like I've never really worked on that, right? Like I've always, you know, like when he was in Toronto, like he was giving the ball in the post, facing up.
ISO.
Yep, right. Yeah. So he had to kind of so he's like, all right, like let's shoot some kind of deep mid-range shots, you know, like 21, 22 footers.
Right.
They shoot 100, he makes 92, right? And like, I don't think people understand how fucking good these guys are. Like they're they're ridiculous. Like he's like, dude, you should see Rondo win every shooting drill. Like it's crazy. Okay, so now you throw in Steph Curry and Kevin Durant, two guys that you work out, two guys that you help hone their craft. What is a Steph Curry workout like? Like, does he ever miss a shot?
Oh, it's ridiculous. I mean, I've seen him make, you know, 45, 50 straight threes in a row, and you know how hard that is. I don't care if no one's guarding you or not. And it's just so easy. And the one thing about Steph, KD's the same way. If we shoot 100 straight threes, if they make 100, or miss 100, it's the same reaction. They just move on to the next shot, and that's why they're good. They don't get down on themselves.
Yeah,
they don't, you know, put their head down like some guys and grope and moan. They're just so laser focused. I mean, Steph just looks at the rim, grabs the ball, looks at the rim. So I pass him the ball. He's still looking at me. He's just boom, boom. It's like it's world class, and it's just complete to me. Just focus when they do that. You know, Steph has ridiculous range. I mean, I've seen him. You know, we'll work on, you know, the normal NBA threes, but then we'll with KD too. And then we'll work on, you know, as they do in the big three, the 4-point shot,
right?
You know, from out there. So, and they make them, and then they shoot them in the game. You know, so yeah, I know what, you know, Miles went through, because I did the same thing with Kevin Love when he went to Cleveland. You know, he had to become, you know, what they call, I guess, a spacer. You know, and so Kevin went from pinch post, mid post, you know, maybe trail threes to sitting like Chris did in the corner, wait for the pass, you know. So those two guys definitely sacrificed to win championships. And, you know, I think a lot of guys going to, you know, really learn how to shoot.
You're one of the guys, or you're the guy credited with teaching LeBron how to push back past the fatigue barrier. Like one of the, like we on TV and radio, we talk about dumb shit sometimes, you know. Whereas I think like real basketball talk is you're talking about the unbelievable confidence of Durant and Steph Curry. And honestly, sometimes LeBron has lacked that kind of stuff, like confidence and conditioning and the ability to push through fatigue. How did you, like LeBron credits you with pushing him through the fatigue barrier. How do you do that?
Yeah. And I'll never forget it. We were down in, Miami working out. It was me, him and John Wall. And it's just, I don't know. I don't know what it is about me. I don't know if it's, my dad's lieutenant colonel. And I, since day one, I've been treating these guys just like grown men, not like NBA players or MVPs. And I hold them accountable. If a guy shows up at 9:02, I get pissed. And I think these other trainers out there are guys that, you know, it's okay, man. You know, don't worry about it. Because in any other industry, you know, if you're late for work, you get fired all the time, you know. Or I always tell them, if you're late for the plane in the NBA, it's $5,000. So give me $5,000 or, you know, don't be late. So, you know, with me, I don't treat them like I think a lot of people treat them. And honestly, they like that. You know, they want someone in their life, especially that's trying to help their craft, to be honest with them. You know, not say, it's okay, you know, if they don't work hard that day, it's okay, man, you know, or it's the coach's fault. You had a bad game, it's the coach's fault. I'm the opposite, you know, and I'm honest with them, and I push them to the limit. And my last drills always are the hardest drills, and I always do that for a reason. I always say, you know, you should end the workout better than you finish, just like you should be better in the fourth quarter than you are the first quarter. So I test guys. I test guys at the end of work. The last 5 minutes are the hardest drills I'll do all day. Mm-hmm. And I do that to prepare them with 2 minutes left in the game. You know, you're going to be able to make that shot when you're tired. You're going to be able to handle the ball, you know, when guys guard you full court when you're tired down one. So it's strategic, but it's also, you know, again, just holding them accountable. And, you know, I said, give me 1 hour. That's all I want, 1 hour a day. That's all it is. It's not 9 to 5. And I love the guys that say, you know, I've been in the gym 8 hours.
Yeah, man. That's the biggest bullshit.
You can't be working that hard.
Correct. Sure. This is one of the things that I think is amazing to me. It's either a lie or you're not getting stuff done.
Exactly.
Right, with younger kids, I tell them, like, you know, like 40, 45 minutes is plenty.
Yeah.
You know?
As long as you're going hard.
If you're going hard, right? Like, otherwise, you're just kind of waiting. Like, I get parents where I run workouts, and like, well, they only went an hour today. Like, dude, they went hard. They're good. They're done. Like, do you want me to have them do three-man weave? If you want me to have them do three-man weave, you know, sure, cool. But that's a complete waste of my time and yours as well. Okay, exactly. So
KD will go 40 minutes with me in this back in the day, and no water break, it'd be done. 40 minutes. Yeah. Rob, what's the next drill? Want some water? No, next, let's go. Boom, 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 boom. I'm not sitting there talking for 10 minutes in between drills. Done. Go enjoy your summer. You're like, that's it. You know?
Give me a guy who is going to have a great – you spent time with him, and you feel like he's going to take a step this year.
I'd say one guy for sure, Alfred Payton. Hmm. I worked at Alfred the last 2 years, but this is the first really full summer that we had together. And, you know, he signed with the Knicks, obviously. He's comfortable up there. Scott Perry drafted him in Orlando. It's a team with a lot of guys with chips in their shoulders. Alfred's been known to be an average shooter, but we worked out a shot a ton this summer. I mean, 6 days a week in L.A. And he's grown. You know, he's matured. He's more of a leader. And he's confident now. He's very, you know, when I first met him, quiet guy, you know, not too sure of his shot. If he opened the 17, you know, 15-foot line, he wouldn't shoot it. But now one of those things, too, you know, it's going to go in there with a little swag, a little confidence. And they want him to shoot this year, so he's definitely a guy I think is going to take a big, big step forward.
The book is Net Work, guy. It's awesome. You should pick it up. He's Rob McClanahan, of course, who's a star workout. I mean, would you do? Do you want guru, trainer of the stars? How do you, when you get introduced when you're having beers? Like, is my buddy Rob? He's the trainer of the stars. Is that what you want?
Trainer's fine. Yeah. Trainer's fine. Yeah, it's funny when my guys, you know, I'm having beers. This is the guy I told you about. He trains this and that. And sometimes I don't even want to get into it. Somebody, if people ask me, no, I'm a teacher. So yeah, I do marketing because I don't want to get into it. So people I don't know, you know.
Network training the NBA's best and finding the keys to greatness. Rob, great stuff, man. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Doug. Appreciate it, man.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
Hey, that's it for All Ball. You can keep the tweets, the liked ones, the hater ones, at Gottlieb Show, or listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app. And remember, download, subscribe, rate, tell a friend about All Ball.